A senator is faced daily with difficult decisions. The toughest, says James Aberesk, is deciding whether being a senator is worth sacrificing your personal life. After a term in the House and another in the Senate, Aberesk decided it wasn't. He left Congress in 1979 and resumed his law practice. He reflects on his life in and out of office in his new book, Advise and Dissent. As the Democratic senator from South Dakota, Aberesk was known as a liberal maverick. He supported Indian rights and the creation of a Palestinian state. He opposed political action committees and the deregulation of natural gas. Aberesk is the founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. His parents were Lebanese immigrants who came to the United States at the turn of the century and made their home on a Sioux Indian reservation in South Dakota. Aberesk has said that Arabs are the only group that Americans feel it's still safe to stereotype. I asked him to give some examples.
If you watch the television show, some of the television shows, people of Arab descent are never portrayed in anything but the most negative way. There's never a positive Arab. I think the last positive Arab was Danny Thomas in his television show, and then he was called a Lebanese. He wasn't even called an Arab at that time. But they're shown as villains. And the same is true with films nowadays. Let's take a very good movie, Back to the Future. At the beginning, they showed an event with a Libyan terrorist, which was just totally out of context. I mean, it had no place in there except to add to the stereotype of Arabs as being terrorists.
What was the first time you went to the Middle East?
1973 in August, and the second time was in December of 73.
And what effect did it have on you?
Well, I tell you, it had a dramatic impact on me. When I went to the refugee camps, the Palestinian camps in Lebanon, I came away totally amazed and totally shocked at what I saw and what I learned there. I came back to America quite angry at the whole thing.
When did you start identifying as an Arab?
I don't know. Of course, I've always been an Arab since my birth. But I didn't really know much about the Middle East conflict until 1971. When I arrived in Washington, I was very ignorant as to the conflict, and I've been learning about it ever since.
Mm-hmm. In your new autobiography, Advise and Dissent, you talk a little bit about your parents and how they came to the United States from Lebanon. Your father came here in 1918.
No, 1898.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's even earlier than I thought.
Yeah. Well, he came over in 1898. He went back in 1907 or 8 and married my mother, and they had two children. Then he left her there in 1912, and came back saying he would send for him after he got some money. Unfortunately, World War I intervened. He came back and opened a store on the Indian Reservation in South Dakota, in Wood, South Dakota, on the Rosebud Sioux Reservation. And he ran the store until 1920. After the war, he was able to send her enough money to come here. So she came with my brother and sister, Chick and Helen, and they were, I think, 9 and 8, respectively, 9 years old and 8 years old, respectively. And then there were three more of us born after that, and he opened another store in Mission, South Dakota, still on the same reservation in 1920.
So, now, you were born in 1931, and you grew up on the Sioux Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota, yes?
Right.
Can you explain how your father ended up, your father, a Lebanese immigrant to America, ended up on an Indian reservation in South Dakota?
Well, he was a pack peddler at the beginning. He did a lot of things. He sold snow cones during the land rush. He was a lawman for a time. He was a great big strapping fellow. And then he peddled spices and linens out of a pack on his back. He walked at first, then he bought a horse, then he bought a team and buggy, and eventually opened a store. And I don't know exactly how he wound up on that particular reservation, but that's where he landed in 1912.
Were there many non-Indians living on the reservation?
Oh, there were a number. I mean, the majority were Indian people at that particular time. And, for example, the town of Wood has, you know, the business people were all non-Indians. And in the town of Mission, actually, where he opened his second store, the business people were all non-Indians. But there were an awful lot of Indians around there. The majority was Indian.
Now, you write that you looked down on Indians until you left the reservation. Why did you look down on them when you were there, and then what changed you?
Well, I grew up, doing the same thing as the adults on the reservation, that is, being racist toward the Indian people. And actually, after I left the reservation, a friend of mine sort of slapped me in the face with what I'd been doing, how a racist I'd been acting.
Can you remember exactly what it was that this friend said to you that made you have a change of heart?
I'm going to try to recall. I think she said her name is Peggy Goodart, who she's now a history professor out at Sacramento State University in California. I was saying, well, we treat our Indians good back there in Woods, South Dakota, and she said, that's exactly it. They're not your Indians, Jim. It was something like that, and suddenly it dawned on me.
Mm-hmm. Did you see yourself as a member of a minority group when you were one of the non-Indians living on the reservation?
In a way, I did, yes. Although my father was a, you know, fairly successful merchant, we had a different culture than most people, and we were, in fact, at one point, the kids used to call me a dirty Jew. And, my parents spoke with an accent, and they didn't know the difference between Jewish or Arab or whatever. They just called me a dirty Jew. And, I felt a little bit of the sting of discrimination back then, but not a great deal.
Mm-hmm. When you grew up, you worked for a while as a bartender, a wholesale grocer, an engineer. Why did you go into politics?
Well, I had a lot of energy and I suppose a fairly good-sized ego, because people who do go into politics do it in part to satisfy their ego. The other part, I felt that I could do some good in public service. I thought, my ideas were worthwhile, and I thought that's the way to express those ideas, was to get into politics and see how many people I could convince.
Mm-hmm. You ran for Attorney General and lost. Ran for the House and won, and after two terms in the House. One term in the House, you were elected to the Senate, but you left after one term. You decided not to run again. Can we talk about some of the things that bothered you when you were in the Senate?
Well, first of all, it was what bothered me most was the way one has to conduct his or her personal life in there. In fact, to really do a good job as a senator, you have to forget about your friends and your family, and that's not the kind of life I wanted to live. Your schedule is controlled by your staff, by contributors, by constituents. It's not over at 5 o'clock. Your day is not finished then. Usually I found myself on the Senate floor at night when everyone else was at home having dinner with their family. Senators are sitting there, including me, listening to some long-winded guy make a speech, waiting for the final vote on a bill. Or if you're not doing that, you're out at a reception trying to please some constituent or some fundraiser, some contributor. Appearing at a reception or a dinner that they've thrown and asked you to come to. And you're, as a politician, you don't really want to antagonize people like that. So you find yourself sort of trapped in somebody else's time schedule and not your own.
James Aberesk is my guest, former South Dakota senator and now the national chair of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. What's the position you took in the Senate that you felt cost you most in terms of popularity among your constituents?
Well, it was a combination of issues. I was a dissenter. People call it maverick, but I prefer the term dissenter. I dissented from the popular view on the oil industry, for example, and on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, on American Indians, which was not a very popular issue out in South Dakota. I mean, there's an awful lot of racism out there. A lot of good people in South Dakota, but there's still some racism on and around the Indian reservations themselves. That cost me support in certain areas. I suppose everything one does costs support, one way or the other. If you do something, you're bound to make enemies as well as friends.
Now, you mentioned your stand on Native Americans having cost you in popularity in South Dakota. When your future is dependent on being reelected, it's difficult to stand up for the disenfranchised. Or for any minority, because that's not what's going to necessarily get you the majority vote. Is that something you thought about a lot when you were in office?
Not really, no, because I decided about a year after I was in the Senate that I wasn't going to run again. It was a great liberating feeling, which allowed me to vote my conscience more than most politicians are allowed.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a little bit about Wounded Knee. As you point out, you became involved with Native American issues just at the time of Native American militancy. And at the Siege of Wounded Knee, you were asked to come to hear the demands and to hear the grievances, and you were invited along with Henry Kissinger, William Fulbright, Ted Kennedy. You were the only one of that group who was willing to go. Why did you want to go?
Well, first of all, I was chairman of the Indian Affairs Subcommittee, and secondly, that was the siege took place in my state of South Dakota. I could hardly not go. I could hardly ignore the request to come out there and try to do something about releasing hostages.
You say when you were on the phone to Russell Means the first time you called in to find out what was happening, you were having a conversation with him, and suddenly you overheard somebody saying to him, "CBS is here," and suddenly his tone of voice changed completely, and he started hollering these angry demands.
Oh, that's what he did. I was talking to him about what we were going to do, and I heard him say, "Uh-oh, CBS just came in the door." And all of a sudden, the tone of his voice changed. He started shouting militant demands at me. And then later on, when McGovern and I went to Wounded Knee, and we stood out there negotiating in a semicircle or a circle, and Russell Means got up and denounced me, and then he came over behind me a little later on and said, "Don't pay any attention to what I just said." He was putting on a show, in effect.
What was the point of that show?
Well, I suppose it's what the Indians wanted to do. They were their policy then, the militant Indians, was confrontation. And that's the way they saw as the best way to attract attention to their grievances.
Did you feel that your presence had any effect on the resolution of the conflict?
Oh, not at all. No, it went on 71 days after I was there. It couldn't have had much effect on it. Although at the time, I had thought I'd convinced Russell Means to give it up. In fact, he agreed to. We negotiated the day I went out there. It was the first or second day of the siege. I had told him afterward, I said, "Look, Russ, this has got to come to an end at some point. Why don't you end it sooner rather than later before somebody gets hurt?" He said, "Well, I think you're right. Why don't you find out from the FBI? We'll give it up." He said, "You find out who's going to be charged, what charges, and how much bail will be set so we can have our lawyers ready for it." So I went out and told the FBI agent that, and I don't think that ever got transmitted to anybody, because it went on for 70 more days, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, later on when they were having the trials, the government prosecutor called me and wanted me to testify, and I said, I don't really want to. He said, "Well, I'll subpoena you." I said, "Okay, fine." I said, "Here's what I'll testify to." I told him about that incident, about telling the FBI that they wanted to give up. He said, "Well, on second thought, I don't think we need your testimony."
Did you feel used at all?
I suppose a little bit. I mean, everybody uses everybody at some point or another. But, you try to make the best of it and try to make the best outcome.
You were one of the key votes in the Panama Canal Treaty, and President Carter really wanted to convince you to vote on his side. What were you holding out for? You knew you were a key vote. Did you make any deals?
Well, I tried to make a deal. Carter had the requisite number of votes lined up. That was 67, which he needed to pass the treaty. And I had heard at that time about Schlesinger, who was Secretary of Energy, and Carter sponsoring meetings up in the White House in an effort to deregulate natural gas. What they were doing was inviting certain selected members of the Energy Conference Committee to the White House to try to twist their arm. I thought that was illegal. I just didn't think it was right because I was a member of the conference committee and I wasn't invited, neither were other opponents of deregulation. So I finally called the White House liaison and I said, "Look," I said, "I've heard about these meetings up there and I'm going to tell you what, I'm withdrawing my favorable vote on the Panama Canal Treaty and I'm going to vote against it unless these meetings absolutely stop and Carter and Schlesinger stop interfering with the Energy Conference Committee of the House and the Senate." So, my vote was then announced as being against it, and the treaty would then fail. So Carter kept calling me, and he was, in fact, he made one of the great lobbying efforts. I guess you'd call it Rush Week in college, right? He made a tremendous lobbying effort. Actually, I had intended all along to vote for the treaty, but I wanted to try to extract these concessions from him on him butting out of the energy conference thing. In fact, Carter, who had started out being against deregulation, turned around in the middle of the filibuster that Howard Metzenbaum and I conducted in 1977 and changed his policy and then began lobbying very heavily for deregulation.
Would you tell the phone booth story when you were on the phone with Carter?
Well, it was one of the times, he had me up to the Oval Office I don't know how many times. He was on the phone to me constantly. He called everybody in the country who was a friend of mine to try to get them to convince me to vote for the treaty. So he called me once in the cloakroom, in the Senate cloakroom, and I went in the phone booth in the cloakroom to take his call. He was on the phone pleading, just begging me to vote for the treaty. I thought it was embarrassing, I thought it was beneath his dignity to beg just a mere U.S. senator that way, and I was telling him so. Just then I smelled smoke, And I turned around, and it was one of those folding glass doors. And I looked around, and a friend of mine, Senator John Culver of Iowa, had taken a paper towel and stuck it through the crack in that folding door and had lit one end of it, and it was burning toward me like a fuse. And the booth was filling with smoke. And I went, "My God," and Carter said, "What's wrong? Did I say something wrong?" And I said, "No, it's just John Culver trying to burn me out of the phone booth."
Well, did you think, hey, what a really entertaining prank, or were you really angry?
Oh, no. John Culver weighs 260 pounds. How can you get angry at him? He's a former football player in college. No way.
So did you leave the phone booth?
I got the towel put out. I put the paper towel out, and then I kept talking to Carter.
Mm-hmm. You decided after a year in the Senate to not run again. One of your former aides mentioned, was quoted in an article several years ago by the journalist Drummond and Whitcover, that he thought part of the reason why you decided not to run again was that because of your anti-Israeli views, you would have lost the Jewish vote and Jewish financial support. Did that have anything to do with it?
No, not really. There is no Jewish vote to speak of in South Dakota, neither is there any Arab vote there to speak of. Jewish financial support, I suppose, would have been made up by people in this country who agree with my position. So that didn't really worry me. I didn't run for the Senate for the reasons I stated earlier. It was not a kind of a life I wanted to lead forever.
You would like to see the PLO be recognized. You've tried to block United States money to Israel. What kind of response did this get in South Dakota, where there isn't a large Jewish population?
Well, actually, the response, from what little response I got was favorable, because people, generally accepted my judgment on matters like that. I can tell you one story about how people feel in South Dakota about this. In 1974, after I made a full-fledged tour of the Middle East, including Israel and the Arab countries, I came back and made a series of speeches in South Dakota based on what I'd seen there. The first event I had was in Sioux Falls. There were 400 or 500 people in the audience. And from the floor, a Zionist, a supporter of Israel, was debating me from the floor, and I was up at the podium. And we went back and forth. I was enjoying it immensely. And suddenly, from the back of the room, a farmer got up and said, "Look, why don't you two guys take your tribal warfare somewhere else, and let's talk about something important like hogs." And that's basically that's the attitude. It's a farm state. People are interested in agriculture.
Mm-hmm. You went on a mission, I forget the year this was, to free U.S. hostages held in Lebanon by the Hezbollah.
1986.
And you were denied access, and you were told, well, that this group is just a bunch of Americans. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I was highly disappointed, because I had taken over signatures on petitions, thousands and thousands and thousands of signatures from people of Arab descent in this country asking the Hezbollah to release these innocent hostages. And, we went to a lot of effort, and we felt very sorry, and still do, for the innocent people being held hostage over there. I mean, it's a very brutal existence for those people. And we wanted to do our best to free them, and unfortunately, the Hezbollah wouldn't talk to us. The president of Syria, Hafez al-Assad, cooperated very well and tried to set up the meeting, but they just wouldn't do it.
How much influence do you feel that you have in Arab countries politically or toward hostage takers and terrorists?
Well, I can tell you this, absolutely none. I have no influence whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to something that we were talking about earlier, which is things that bothered you when you were in the Senate. You read in your book that being a senator doesn't include great intellectual conversations, that it comes down more to making a lot of decisions. What kinds of decisions were you thinking of?
You don't really have time for intellectual discussions with anyone. What you have to do is decide, first of all, which office do you want to select? It's all decisions. Which dinner invitation do I take? Which reception do I go to tonight? When there's a vote coming up on the floor, if you don't know what the vote is, you have to ask somebody very quickly, because you have 15 minutes from the time the bell rings. If it's a surprise amendment, and you're not prepared for it, which in a lot of cases you're not, you have to go ask somebody else. There was a guy who used to be stationed down there, the secretary to the Senate. He was stationed at the doorway, and so if it was a surprise amendment, I'd walk in on the Senate floor, as did other senators who were surprised, and I'd say, how would I vote on this one, or how the good guys voting on this one? He'd say, Senator, you'd vote yes on this one, knowing, you know, my proclivities. And he would probably tell Jim Eastland, you'd vote no on this one, because Eastland and I rarely voted together.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the Senate has changed since you left?
Well, I'm told by former colleagues up there that it's become a more grim place. It's really not much fun anymore. You know, people ought to try to enjoy the work they do, and I guess nobody enjoys it much anymore up there, although they stay there, I grant you that. But they say it's very grim and humorless, and sometimes it gets downright mean.
Is that any different from when you were there?
Oh, yeah, sure. No, there were some interesting characters when I was there. Jim Eastland, you know, all of those people. Hubert Humphrey, that are no longer there, and there's nobody there to replace them.
Do you ever miss the Senate?
No, I miss the Watts line, actually, that they used to provide me, but I don't miss the Senate at all.
Are you ever on the other side now in the position of lobbying senators?
No, I've never lobbied. I've thought about it at times, and I thought, well, that's not really the life I want to lead either, so I've never lobbied up there. What I do is virtually every election year after the election, I go up to the cloakroom and needle my former colleagues by saying, I'm recruiting for my law firm. Anybody need a job? You know, the ones who are defeated. So that doesn't go over too well. But it was fun.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.